life,
dignity,
security,
freedom,
respect,
justice,
equality,
equality,
remedy, and succession,
fairness,
fair trial,
criticism,
right,
work,
peace,
losers,
men.
This is my mistake, and let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression.
Expression.
Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Leisure.
Leisure.
Health.
Education.
Protest.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solidarity.
Responsibility.
Fill in the border. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good day to our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We are building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a global collection of musicians. I'm Jim Hutchings, and I'm joined today by my co-host Mona Hill. And Canada's National Aboriginal Day is annually held on June 21st. To celebrate the unique heritage, diverse cultures, and outstanding achievements of the nation's Aboriginal peoples. There are three Aboriginal groups in Canada, the First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples. Today, on Human Rights Radio, we'll spend the hour talking with Dr. Joyce Green, University of Regina, Senior Fellow, the Saskatchewan Institute of Public Policy. Joyce is a professor of political science at the University of Regina. Her research interest has been focused on Aboriginal settler relations and the possibility of decolonization in Canada, and a transformative ecology of relationship with place, epitomized by many traditional Aboriginal conceptions of land and place. What a mouthful, Mona. Take it away.
Welcome back, everyone. We have to make a correction. I made a mistake. You're not a fellow anymore.
The Saskatchewan Institute of Public Policy is no more, so I am no longer a fellow either.
Oh, okay. Which I didn't know. Well, how did that happen?
Another cut?
A long story, perhaps, for another
time. For another show. Okay. Welcome, Joyce Green.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
I have to tell the audience, at the start of the show, I'm going to tell them that this is my last show on Human Rights Radio, for the simple matter that my job is preventing me from maybe doing the job that I need to do on the show, and vice versa, because it is a voluntary position. So Amnesty International is working hard to find a way to continue to keep Human Rights Radio going. I will miss the show terribly. I've had a wonderful, absolutely wonderful 3 years. We've done some amazing work educating the public on so many, a myriad of human rights issues, and hopefully made a difference in some people's lives. And the difference that has been made in my life, Joyce Green has been there. Joyce was a professor of mine when, as a very mature adult, I went to university to get my degree in social work. And what's really interesting, I realized last night, is my very first show 3 years ago in June consisted of myself and another mentor from the social work faculty at the University of Regina was Professor Miguel Sanchez, who was, we talked about refugees and immigrants. It was my very first show, and here we are on my very last show with a woman who undoubtedly had a huge influence on my life because of taking a class with her. And welcome, Joyce. It's such an honor to have you here.
Well, thanks so much, Mona. And one of the lovely surprises about teaching is sometimes we find good friends through the process. You're not my student. You are my friend and my compañera in struggle.
Sometimes that's scary because you're kind of crazy. It's been wonderful. So, Joyce, we're gonna sort of talk about her interests and what she's done in her life. And before we do that, just wanted to make it clear that you're not currently in the process of teaching at the university. You're on the disability for a little while.
I'm on disability leave. Mm-hmm. I'm not allowed to work. So right. What we are doing today is
this
called
is all
fun.
Volunteer work, and we're having fun. Yeah. So your most recent publication is in Making Space for Indigenous Feminism. And that one I haven't read. Is it available?
No, I'm afraid you really must update your notes. My most recent publication is in the Prairie Forum in 2012.
Okay.
And it's entitled something or other about Indigenous human rights. I can't really remember. But Making Space for Indigenous Feminism is 2007.
Okay. The past, so the writing, I mean, the things that are interesting to you and the things that are important to you all hinge, for the most part, there's a few different aspects that weave their way through. We've got from Stone Child to social cohesion, anti-racist challenges for Saskatchewan. So we've got racism here. We've got self-determination, citizenship, and federalism, Indigenous and Canadian pamphlet. I said it. And if you want to look up pamphlet, it's it's not even pronounced that way. Palimpsest, is that right?
That's it.
Okay, PALIMPSEST. Go ahead and find it on Google. In Reconfiguring Aboriginal State Relations, which is, a journal? That's where you would find it. Oh, and the other one is Parsing Identity and Identity Politics. From the International Journal of Critical something.
Critical Indigenous Studies.
There you go. Research interests. Here's where we're going to start. The indigenization of the university, a project ranging from inclusion of Aboriginal ideas and people to transformation of the canon, is a matter at the top of my research agenda for the foreseeable future. Canadian Constitution and Politics, Aboriginal Decolonization, and Critical Postcolonial and Feminist Theory. There you have Joyce in a nutshell. Besides that, she's so much fun to be with. Okay. So the indigenization of university, where does that take you?
That is a project that currently preoccupies most of my thinking and writing time. And what I mean by indigenization of the university is the changing of the university so that Indigenous peoples and students and thoughts, knowledge, are thoroughly incorporated into the kinds of things that we teach in the ivory towers. Up to this point in time, including Aboriginal people has typically meant the university invites Aboriginal people to be part of the university, but the university never examines what, in fact, it is and what its power relations are. Given that I argue knowledge is political, the knowledge that universities replicate tends to be the kinds of knowledge that affirm the status quo for Aboriginal peoples. That's about oppression. So transforming the university means changing the kind of knowledge we teach to all of our students. And I think we owe all of our students a more thorough and critical knowledge. And it also means that the university itself will be transformed by the inclusion of Aboriginal peoples and knowledges. And that should mean that, again, all of our students develop a better understanding about our society and its power relations, its contestation about each other, because right now our communities don't know each other very well and don't seem to want to.
I agree completely. So how does that take into the newest active opportunity that Juliana Beaudry-Herney has sort of started going at the university on, you know, trying to get Indigenous Studies 100, for instance, into pretty well every faculty, so that it would be something that people would have to take regardless of whether they wanted to or not, because it's a little bit controversial. We did have her on the show to talk about it.
Sure.
And, you know, what that meant to her, and it's very important to her, very personal to her.
Sure it is. It's a great initiative. It's a good first step. Indigenization of the university means much more fundamental transformation than asking non-Indigenous students to take one course out of the entire panoply of courses they take towards a BA or a BSc. But it is a good place to start, because currently most of them take nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And good honor for having the courage to raise this in an environment which is often racist, and where she has been targeted by those kinds of racialized attacks, simply because she's asking people to take one course to learn about something that affects all of us.
Right. And then we take it a step further, and because we have Human Rights Radio, we want to talk a little bit about your perspective on Aboriginal human rights for the rest of the half hour, Indigenous peoples' historical perspective on the environment, I would say, in the second half hour, your perspective, and we'll continue on. I'm going to read something that you sent to me. We must go beyond only human concerns and protect all of creation. If we are not to so foul our own nest that we destroy the earth and all who inhabit it. So that's how we're going to end the show.
Sounds good.
Let's talk about starting the show. Your concept on human rights, Joyce, you and I had a good conversation the other day about what it means to you.
Well, human rights are something that we have developed primarily to resist oppression. And if we did not have oppression by others, we wouldn't need human rights. In that, it's something like colonialism, which I'll get to in a few minutes. So human rights are the kinds of frameworks that we have thought up and put in place in legal regimes to say that all human beings are worthy of respect and worthy of equality of treatment, so that they have essentially the fundamentals for a meaningful life. The primary oppressor of human beings have been governments. And so human rights regimes are intended to constrain governments in how they treat their citizens.
So, and yes, this is true. Back after World War II was really when governments started looking at the possibility of a human rights declaration. And that's where, as Amnesty sort of comes in here, we talk about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And one of the things that we've noticed, and that you mentioned in your notes that you sent me, was that just because we have a Declaration of Human Rights doesn't necessarily mean that all governments believe that they are bound by it.
It's true. And the thing about international law is it has been premised on the proposition that governments would choose to be bound by it, that states are sovereign and that they cannot be interfered with in how they manage their internal affairs. And, of course, human rights law proposes to do just that. It proposes to interfere with governments that violate the human rights of their citizens. So there's a bit of a tension there. But nevertheless, the international community and most states have developed human rights regimes and have agreed to be bound by them. So there is a proposition here that political power or military power does not entitle one to abuse the rights of one's fellow citizens. And some states are better at respecting human rights than others, and some states are better at certain times than others, and some states are absolutely terrible. Having said that, we nevertheless have now developed a robust legal and political theory that says human rights are worthy of protection and that states are bound, even if they don't agree. So we no longer think that it is acceptable, for example, as Syria is presently doing, to violate the rights of citizens and then claim that this is an internal matter not to be interfered with.
And then, of course, yesterday I was listening to CBC and they were talking about this very issue about Syria, and that was what was going on in my mind. Is so now what? Now the responsibility of the international community to respond.
Yes.
so far hasn't been happening despite all these human rights violations.
Yeah, and that is a problem of international politics. There are only a certain number of ways in which states can respond. And generally, states respond based also on their perceived self-interest. So they choose to intervene in some places, think Afghanistan or Iraq. And they choose not to intervene in others. And
how much does economics have to do with that decision?
Oh, probably 85%. Economics and military and strategic relationships. Mm-hmm. So human rights are often invoked as a reason, but they generally are a stalking horse for other interests. We're not very good in international politics at having a single standard that mobilizes all states together to protect human rights.
And most recently, in 2007, we have the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Canada did what would be the phrase, accept this in 2007.
That was an interesting...
Was that 2007
it
already?
It was.
No, it was 2010.
We didn't adopt it in Canada until 2010.
Adopted in 2010. Yeah. And what I found interesting about that was Australia was the country to adopt it just before we did. Mm-hmm. They had a big, huge international celebration that it was adopted. Canada announced, I think it was on a Friday afternoon, and I've been reading recently that when things like this occur with the Canadian government, these big announcements that could cause, I don't know, embarrassment or something to them, they'll do it on a Friday afternoon when there isn't a lot of media and there's not, the whole weekend is gone, nobody's paying attention. And that's basically what they did. There was no announcement, there was nothing. They just voted to adopt it.
Governments are very skillful at media management. One can be assured that if they had wanted media to pay attention to this, and thus the public to pay attention to it, it would have been announced at a more auspicious time. But the entire saga of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is an interesting one. The first thing I'd like to draw our attention to is it's a declaration, just like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So declarations in international law are aspirational statements about what we'd like the world to be like, but it isn't yet. The Harper government, nevertheless, fought this thing to a standstill. It was the second to the last government to adopt the UN Declaration of Human Rights. It claimed, wrongly, that the declaration would violate constitutional law in Canada. It lobbied other states to try and produce a consensus to stop the United Nations adopting the declaration. And that was the first time in Canada's history that such activity had been generated in opposition to human rights developments internationally. So it was quite interesting to me and quite alarming that our federal government would react this way to a mild declaration about the rights of Indigenous peoples in this country.
When that was occurring and I was leafing through this declaration, the first thing that hit my mind was there's a lot of stuff in here about resources, an awful lot.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me, this is probably what's really behind this inability or this lack of interest in accepting this declaration and instituting these rights for our Indigenous population, resources, financial resources.
One wonders if, in fact, this was the concern. And that takes me to a second issue that generates the need for Indigenous rights, and that is colonialism. A lot of people don't understand what it is, and they think it's an historical event, something that happened back then, but we really don't have any colonialism now. Or they think that colonialism is something that happens elsewhere. You know, the Blue Water thesis, that it happens when people go somewhere else and impose their way of life or their politics, and then they leave. In Canada, colonialism was inspired by the search of certain European nations for wealth and for political and strategic opportunities. And they found it here in what we've always called Turtle Island. So they came here and then planted permanent colonies and initiated a number of political and military efforts which involved Indigenous peoples, sometimes as allies and sometimes as enemies. But at some point, they were able to force Indigenous peoples to accept that the colonial population was dominant and in control. And I won't go into a history lesson here. The bottom line is colonialism is motivated by the search for someone else's land and resources. And it always involves domination and subordination. That's the Canadian legacy. But it isn't historical because it continues to happen, as your comment just observes. Mm-hmm. Indigenous peoples, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit have been stripped of lands and resources and political sovereignty. And so the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples recognizes that and affirms the rights of Indigenous peoples to have control over the resources in their land and their sovereignty. The Canadian state might imagine that this means having to give something back or pay reparations or include Indigenous peoples meaningfully in decision-making, as I suspect it does.
And I think a perfect example of that is a year or so ago, just over a year ago, there was a group of people from Northern Saskatchewan, the Committee for Future Generations, who decided to band together to object to the burial of nuclear waste in Saskatchewan. And they had their good reasons, and we all should have paid attention to that. The concept of having a say in the matter as to whether or not they want to be a part of it, whether they want to accept a company coming in to bury nuclear waste, and really what is going on, why do they want burying nuclear waste? Anyway, they got together and they decided, we want to have a say in this. And it's been one hell of a journey for this group of people. And just recently, probably a month ago in the legislature, they presented over 12,000 signatures on petitions from people all over the province, as well as outside of the province, to battle against this. And the government, our provincial government, is still hedging on this. For what possible reason, when the people have said, this is not what we want?
Yeah. Well, and it's wonderful to see solidarity on this. Just two things for our listeners to know. The Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples protects the right of Indigenous peoples to what we call FPIC, free, prior, and informed consent on all developments on their territories or affecting their livelihoods. So this is a legal obligation at international law now. Similarly, the Canadian Supreme Court has determined that Indigenous peoples must be consulted before governments or their corporate allies engage in initiatives that affect Indigenous lands, land claims, and traditional territories. So these two principles, free, prior, and informed consent, and the right to meaningful consultation, which is more than just holding a town hall meeting,
right,
they must be observed by our governments before they initiate activity that affects Indigenous peoples and lands.
Right. And that's an interesting concept when one takes into account the people in, let's say, British Columbia, who are currently taking a stand on a pipeline to transport oil through their land, and finding themselves being labeled as terrorists.
Yes. I've wondered about that as well. First, it makes it appear that our federal and perhaps some provincial governments are in violation of constitutional and international law in this regard about the need for consultation and for substantial agreement. But secondly, it also makes me worry about the quality of our democracy when citizens who gather together to speak on public issues are criminalized or stigmatized or in other ways intimidated by those same governments. This seems to me to erode the quality of our democracy.
And that leads us to, I think, racism, in my opinion.
Yes. Racism is a very useful ideology that legitimates the oppression of some by others, and I'm hoping that perhaps after the break we can talk more about that.
Sure we can. How much time do we have, Jim? 2 minutes. All right. You can go. You use the term myth, a mythology, in some of the notes that you sent me in regards to The myth says nothing about land theft, repressive legislation, and racist political culture.
The great Canadian myth.
The great Canadian myth. It is silent about the intergenerational suffering that has marked so many Indigenous communities, and which the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is hearing about now in Saskatchewan, and we know it's traveling through the province. And if, you know, we take that back to the term racism, and we take it back to colonialism, and, you know, colonialism legitimizing the process of racism?
Other way around. Colonialism is legitimated by racism.
Legitimated by
racism. In which some people are taught that their benefits are in some way uncontroversial. So the fact that Canada gets Indigenous lands and resources and that Indigenous peoples are subordinated and tormented by legislation like the Indian Act, is viewed as necessary for development, or it's a result of their primitiveness, or we were just trying to help. So there's all of this kind of racist justification for the oppression of the Canadian state.
And on that note, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back after to continue our conversation with Dr. Joyce Green at this time during National Aboriginal Days.
Thy bark, old friend. shall the wild bird sing, and still thy branches bend. Old tree, the storm still brave, and woodman leave the spot. To save thy axe shall harm it not.
And that is probably one of the first environmentalist songs. Dates back to 1837. The poem was actually written in 1830. And it was sung by Derek B. Scott, professor of critical musicology at the University of Leeds, to his own piano accompaniment. And if you're interested in that kind of singing, you can find it on the website at www.victorianweb.org/mt/parlorsongs/3.html. And if you really want to hear about that stuff and you didn't write that down, contact me and I'll tell you all about it. So anyway, there you go, Mona.
We're back. Welcome back to Human Rights Radio. I'm Mona Hill and this is Jim Hutchings. And our guest today is Dr. Joyce Green, political science professor at the University of Regina, who is currently on disability. And it's National Aboriginal Days. Tomorrow is a big celebration in Regina at First Nations University. And we wanted to take a different type of look at National Aboriginal Days through a human rights perspective. And Joyce has been educating us about human rights and Indigenous people through her perspectives, which have been extremely interesting. Let's move into something you alluded to earlier and you talked a little bit about, and that's white privilege. Take it away.
Well, white privilege is the term that critical race theorists have developed for a system of power that creates privilege for some members of a community at the expense of others. And in our society, it tends to be coded on the basis of whiteness. It absolutely is coded on the basis of Aboriginality, with Aboriginal peoples having the least access to power and privilege in our society. So with white privilege, It is assumed that there is something about whiteness that itself is meritocratic. And so white people are expected to fit into the society which is developed for them. The institutions are developed by and for them. They are placed in these institutions of power. They get educated well in this society. And they understand themselves to be meritocratic, that they have achieved all of this because of their excellence and their hard work. And they fail to see how others who are not similarly situated are unable to succeed regardless of their merit and hard work. Because with white privilege, whiteness functions as an invisible knapsack of assistance to get you through the hoops to get you where you're going. Whereas with Indigenous peoples or racialized others, these same systems filter us out so that we are at best tokenized.
How does that happen? How does that filter work?
It works by being associated with power and with law and with education. And it works because our national myths, the kinds of things that we hear as children or that we're taught in schools and that we replicate in universities, say that this country was a brave initiative created by bold settlers who came here and created something where nothing had been before. But wait a minute. Indigenous peoples were here before and continue to be here. They nevertheless are erased, and they're erased by quite repressive military and police and legislative actions. One of the consequences, of course, is the legacies they've left, the social suffering that exists in Indigenous communities that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is now hearing about. So the ways in which Canada has subordinated Indigenous peoples, one of which was through residential schools, has left such deep wounds that generations later, these societies continue to experience trauma.
Thank you for that. Okay, decolonization. You talk about decolonization. This is not a term I'm not unfamiliar with.
Yes.
It's something that I think is very fascinating. And it sort of blows my mind to think, how could this possibly happen? Why don't you talk a little bit about the process? What do you think the process is? Because different people I've talked to have different ideas about how do we decolonize a country that's been colonized?
Yes. And historically, in the case of countries whose colonial agents were from elsewhere, say, France and Belgium in the Congo, for example, the solution there was that Belgium returned to Belgium, that the Belgium administrative and political apparatus withdrew, leaving the mess behind for the Congolese to take care of. In Canada, the colonial societies that developed here are not going anywhere. They're not going home. This is home. So whatever decolonization is to mean in Canada or in the other settler states, the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand, it has to mean a solution that will include all of us. There have been people who have argued for the boat argument. There'll be a boat at the East Coast and a boat at the West Coast, and you white folks pick the boat you want to take home. I don't support that argument. I don't think it's reasonable. And there is no home to go to for people who have been raised here intergenerationally. Nevertheless, colonialism still occurs, and the repression of Indigenous peoples is still operating thanks to Canadian political power and economic power. So decolonization has got to mean a transformation of the state. It's got to mean a change of political power, and it's got to mean the willing engagement by Indigenous peoples in the state if they choose, or apart from the state if they choose. It cannot mean the enforcement of political and economic solutions by Canada, which has been trying to do that for Indigenous peoples for far too long and with horrific results.
That puts me in mind of a comment that I heard a while back regarding, for instance, government on reserves, that before reserves, Indigenous peoples had their own forms of government, of course, and that currently there are so many issues with councils, tribal councils and reserve governments. There are so many problems that people have got to a point where they don't want to engage in that process. The people who live there, the average citizen on a reserve does not want to engage because, and it occurred to me also that through that process that it was imposed, that this is an imposed system. It's not an original system. When you're using the term Aboriginal, it's not an original system of government, and it has been imposed by the colonizers. So if you're talking decolonization, would it ever be possible to go to for Indigenous peoples to take back their original forms of government, the original forms of running their own affairs? Or would that be impossible?
Oh, anything's possible given political goodwill and energetic engagement by citizens. So let's just unpack this a little. The whole imposition of the category of Indian on all the diversity of Indigenous peoples suggested all these people were the same. And they were Indians.
Right.
Imagine if they'd been looking for turkey. Right. But I digress. So it forces this false unity on all these diverse peoples who are then forced onto these little pocket handkerchiefs of their traditional territories where they were contained by the Northwest and then the RCMP and the Army and by Indian agents. And they were told how they could govern themselves according to the Indian Act, which includes such items as gravel removal and beekeeping as the heads of power for the council. But band councils are always subject to the approval by the Minister of Indian Affairs. So ultimately, our uber Indian agent remains in Ottawa telling status Indians what is good for them on these tiny reserves. Remember, half of all status Indians don't live on reserves, and no Métis and no Inuit are on these communities. So for this small segment, there are reserves. The question of governance need not be what it was traditionally or historically, any more than Canadian government should go back to what we had in 1867, when only propertied white men could vote, for example. Would we want to go back to that? So I think the proposition here is that Indigenous peoples should have the power to choose their own, our own systems of governance, and that these be generally in compliance with international law on accountability, on transparency, and on the equitable treatment of citizens and the protection of human rights.
So how do we find a solution to decolonization within the context of the federal systems, the provincial systems, the civic city systems? How do we do that?
I tend to think that the first step is for non-Indigenous Canadians to give themselves a good history lesson, to understand the nature of white privilege and colonialism, and to understand that this country is rich on Indigenous resources and lands. And decolonization requires giving some of that back. It's not cost neutral, but it is an obligation. And there are huge benefits for all of us, too, in the form of a more just, equitable, and cohesive society. You can't build cohesion on oppression. So I think that we can create something, but the bottom line is for most non-Indigenous people, most white people, they need to suck it up and learn what has happened historically and continues to happen now that enriches some at the expense of others. And then they need to shut up and back off and make space for Indigenous peoples to choose their solutions rather than to continue to try and impose them. We have no lessons to learn from governments that continue to violate democratic precepts, to have all kinds of ethical problems. You can think of some of the problems that have attended both the recent Liberal and the current Conservative governments in Ottawa, problems with elections, problems with funding private agents and with transparency and so on. I don't think Indigenous peoples have anything to learn from these governments, and they may have much to teach them.
I think I agree with that about the teaching aspect of it. And that would bring us, as a perfect segue, into environmental issues.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about human rights, and human rights are an important concept, an important objective, and I'm not arguing that they should in any way be minimized. But when we talk about human rights, we are talking only about human beings. And ultimately, everything else that we consider is related back to human beings. My own view is that the nature of the environmental catastrophe that is now threatening us is precisely because human beings have failed to remember that creation is not just about us, that we are in relationship with everything else on this planet, and that we have responsibilities to it. And I draw much of my thinking for this from traditional Indigenous approaches to how we live with other beings and with the ecosphere. I think there is much to teach us in that as well. If we are to survive this eco-catastrophe, which has been primarily generated by first world industrialized countries, then we are going to have to stop privileging human wants and needs over the interests of everything else on the planet.
Okay. How do we do that?
With great difficulty, because I think the first challenge is changing how we think. I was inspired by a very good political theorist, Laura Genera, last week when she got up at the Canadian Political Science Association and began to talk about the problems of slaughterhouses and the problems of our failure to understand that other creatures also have feelings and, if you wish, an entitlement to live on the world without being imposed upon. That we have the right to take enough to live, but we don't have the right to take it all or to treat their lives and their suffering as of no consequence. And I was in awe of her courage, because it is so difficult to talk about these things without being mocked or marginalized and dismissed. And she did a very effective job. She certainly inspired me with the truth of her words. I think we have to be more careful about how we live on this earth and attentive to the reality that we are one species among many, that we all have a role to play, and that if we are only ultimately concerned about the well-being of ourselves and our own species, this world will be a grayer, more desolate place and ultimately entirely dead very soon.
And if we take that concept And we relate it back to indigenous human rights and colonialism and racism. One of the things that I read recently was that there are the environmental contaminants are higher in the bodies of Aboriginal people than in non-Aboriginal people in this country. I think it's probably similar in other countries too, particularly where there are mining efforts, deforestation, contaminants that are being used in the processes of the mining and deforestation. PCBs, mercury, toxaphones, pesticides. I was recently in Costco, and it kind of blew me away because for some reason I saw this sign, and there was all these great big packages of fruit and vegetables, and they were from Mexico. And for some reason, I saw this vision in my head of these Mexican farmers out there spraying pesticides on all of their fruits and vegetables, because I know that this happens. They're full of them, and they're not protected properly. And we know that there are problems with birth rates. We know there are problems with congenital deformities. We know this has happened in Alberta, for instance, with the Lubicon Cree, that they're experiencing this. We know about, I mean, this has happened all across our country. This is clearly a human rights issue that involves Aboriginal people far more than it does non-Aboriginal people, although I think it's spreading. They did a bit of a survey, and they tested people's bodies. I think it was in Toronto about 5 years ago. Just sort of random people, and asked them if they'd be part of an experiment, like a scientific experiment, and discovered that every single person that they tested had a very high amounts of all sorts of pollutants in their bodies. So it's spreading, and I think that's what I hear in what you're saying, is we don't have a right to do this, not only to human beings, but also to the land, the foods that we eat, the water that we drink, because we are destroying ourselves as well as everything else.
Well, we are, and it reminds us that we're in a closed system. There really is no escape. So
right.
What we do in Mexico or in Little Buffalo to the Lubicon ultimately comes back to haunt us all, because there is one world and all of the systems are interrelated. We can't offload our garbage onto another jurisdiction for very long. But I think the challenge is for us to stop thinking only in terms of human well-being and human rights. I mean, they're important, but as I said before, rights are shields against oppression by other humans. We also need to think about how we shield the rest of the biosphere from human beings. And I don't think that the rights concept works as well. I think the indigenous notion of relationships and responsibilities works better. We need to see ourselves as having responsibilities to this order, to its well-being, understanding that its well-being also ensures our well-being. And I think that will help us to contain our absolutely voracious appetite for everything we want.
And then we have to toss in the component of, once again, of corporatization and corporate power and financial success. Because if we're going to stop it, we have to rethink what we create things with, how we create things, how we market things, how we package things, you know.
Of course, we also need to think about who we are in the world, how we organize ourselves. Mm-hmm. Canada has always prided itself on being a proponent of freedom and democracy. And they're great ideas. I hope that we one day live up to them. So by democracy, we mean popular participation in the decision-making that affects us all. Yet fewer and fewer of us actually participate in even voting, which is the most superficial form of participation.
Right.
So we need more ways for more people to meaningfully participate in political decision-making. And that will affect what kinds of economic decision-making we make. The current order is arguably framed by a small political elite and a small corporate elite that overlap. And we, the citizens, are told that our primary interest is in having a robust economy in
right.
which we can get a paid job. no matter the cost. And so our government is engaging in a number of initiatives, such as the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which it is clearly in favor of, such as the stigmatization and criminalization of civil society dissent. They withdraw funding from citizens, communities that seek to contest government policies. And they enter into more and more free trade agreements, such as the current Pan-Pacific initiative that Canada is so eager to get into, that have the effect of constraining Canadian constitutionalism. So it seems to me that we have privileged the economic over the political, and that most citizens see themselves as workers and consumers, but not as political actors in relationship. Again, if we can go back to that touchstone of Indigenous political thought, the notion of relationship and responsibility, I think we can begin to put some balance on this this over-preoccupation with the economy at the expense of absolutely everything else.
And that brings me to an article I printed off before I came here regarding Harper's disregard for Aboriginal health. And we did have a conversation with Dr. Carrie Barassa a few weeks ago about all the health care cuts to Aboriginal peoples. Thursday before the Monday of April 9th, Stephen Harper dropped this bombshell, as related in a brief announcement posted on the website of the National Aboriginal Health Organization. They lost all their funding.
Yes, and there have been many
similar
incidents. The Native Women's Society of Canada has lost its funding for its research on the lost and murdered women,
right,
on the Sisters in Spirit,
right,
campaign.
The gentleman that wrote this article said something I thought was very interesting, and that is NAHO's work, the advancement and promotion of health and well-being of all First Nations, Inuit and Métis individuals, families, and communities, is not done. Heck, it's barely begun. And there's a disturbing pattern here. The government has also cut funding to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, the First Nations and Inuit Health Branch at Health Canada, oversees what is without question the worst health system in Canada, making every effort to slough off the responsibility onto the provinces and territories. And Jace, his name is Jack Hicks, says an Iqaluit-based suicide researcher summed it up this way. The Conservatives want out of the Aboriginal business. And I thought that was very profound. And I think it relates exactly to what you were talking about regarding criminalizing people who are protesting the economic perception of the government. And we want to use your land to be able to create jobs from our perspective. And we don't really care what you think.
Well, Canada can't get out of the Aboriginal business until it gets off Aboriginal lands and out of Aboriginal resources. In the meantime, it's up to Canadian citizens, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, to think about what kind of a society we really want and what values animate us.
And that's what Dr. Joyce Green has to say on this National Aboriginal Day weekend coming up. Thank you, Dr. Green, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's an honor and a privilege to have you.
Thank you.
And thank you, all you listeners. I will miss Human Rights Radio. And I believe we're going to continue having shows. I'm not sure how we're going to do it yet, but something is in the works.
As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For info on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Every Tuesday at 7 p.m., Amnesty letter writing at Atlantis Coffee, Victoria Avenue and Hamilton Street. Several Amnesty members will be present writing current Amnesty International appeals. Please feel welcome to join them for some letter writing. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."